You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 224.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You've reached The Local Maximum. You've reached another Local Maximum. Finally, a nice day here. I could hear some of the birds outside. Maybe it'll come through on my short intro here. Today, well, first of all, we talked a lot about cryptocurrencies on the show. It's a recurring theme in terms of emerging technology. Obviously, I'm really into it. Very important, particularly Bitcoin, sometimes Ethereum. If you remember going back, we talked about smart contracts a lot. And I know I've been very Bitcoin-centric as of late. So I want to talk to someone who is actually using crypto on a day-to-day basis and is using alternatives like Dash, for which he has found very good reasons. So I want to know what it's like to use crypto on a day-to-day basis and how the technical development around it has changed that experience and has changed in general. So my next guest has been living off crypto since 2016. Let's pull it up. Joel Valenzuela, you've reached The Local Maximum. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It feels the air is kind of thin up here, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's exciting. I have not had an in-person, I mean, Aaron comes here a lot.
Yeah.
But I have not had someone in person on the podcast for a very long time. I think I've had maybe one or two since the pandemic, except for Aaron. So this is a very, very exciting milestone indeed. We have a bunch of things to talk about today. We need to get your background a little bit because, you know, I know that you're living off crypto, lots of interesting stories there, but I mean, that can't be the start of the story. And I don't want to go all the way back and do like 3 hours of backstory. So I don't know where to start, but you've also lived a bunch of places. You've moved to New Hampshire. Seems like New Hampshire is working out for you with crypto. So where do you want to start this? How did you get into crypto to begin with, and what brought you to New Hampshire?
Yeah, I mean, that's the good like 10, maybe 15 max, like backstory thing. The Batman superhero origin story, as it
exactly.
were. So I grew up in a cattle ranch in Mexico. My parents were Silicon Valley yuppies. And my dad worked at Hewlett Packard, and my mom was a journalist, owned their own newspaper, and then they decided they wanted to become cattle ranchers in Mexico. I'm half Mexican. That's where I grew up until I was like 16, homeschooled the whole way. And then since from ages like 16 to 26, I basically traveled around. I lived in France for a little bit, got my master's in Europe, England, and I worked in D.C. Yes.
I have a question that wasn't asked, and it came to mind like,
yes.
So one of your parents is from Mexico, and the other one, they convinced the other one to come down there and do cattle ranching?
Well, yeah. So basically, both of my parents were born in the U.S., but my dad's Mexican.
Okay, okay.
And like, you know, ethnically, I guess 100%, if that's even a thing. It's a little, there is no such thing as ethnically Mexican.
Well, obviously, it's a lot easier to go to Mexico and do this if you have a Mexican background,
yes.
I would think.
It was my dad's family's ranch that they wanted him to come run. And,
right. Okay.
And it was an inheritance. So rather than just sell it, he was like, you know what? I might as well just change careers. And so that's kind of how it worked out.
Okay. So that's a very big change.
Yeah. I mean, that was before it was cool. It's very cool now where it's like, oh, I'm just going to like grow my own food, all this kind of stuff. And so,
yeah, but they usually don't go to Mexico. They usually just go to like, I don't know, somewhere in California.
Yeah, or just down the road.
Down the road.
That kind of thing.
On the roof of the
community
building.
Community garden, you know, whatever. Yeah, so it's basically, I kind of had like I was in the political nonprofit scene, like the think tank world in development, or, you know, as it's very different from, you know, the development kind of stuff. Maybe in your world, it's like fundraising, basically. So
yeah.
I worked in DC for a while, did all that kind of stuff. And then eventually, you always came from what I like to call like a Ron Paul conservative point of view, meaning very close to like modern libertarian, but still like some misgivings on, you know, certain things on, you know, the role of government or whatever. And since then I've gotten a lot more, you know, open-ended pro-liberty or whatever. But in that whole thing was always this knowledge, like as soon as like I'm like a kid, and I'm learning how money works. Oh, where'd money come from? You hear the history of money with barter. And then, okay, well, then you have little rocks or apples that you trade instead. And then eventually you use gold and then you get coins. And then And then like, that's all explained. And all of a sudden paper money. And in my mind, there's this gap. Like, how did we get from paper representations of, you know, gold, which was money,
yeah,
to then just like, just the paper? Like, I never got that gap, that jump.
Right. I'm sure it could be filled in, right? You could probably give us the brief. It used to be representations of gold, right?
Yeah.
So, and at what point did it stop? I mean, you could say completely in the 70s, but
yeah,
several steps between then and...
Yeah. And so that history was always kind of like, I always knew about that, like as a teenager and stuff. And
well, everybody is. It's complicated. You don't really talk about it very much.
Yeah. People,
money just works.
They just don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And so I was always kind of in the back of my mind, like... I knew a lot of people, especially in like libertarian think tank circles, talking about, oh, sound money, we should go back to the gold standard, or all this kind of stuff. And it's always like theoretical. And then they just like, and with no realism of getting to that. And I was like, well, how can I start doing that today? You know? And other than hoarding gold coins and stuff. And so that's a great setup to where
some people
I
do
today.
Hoard gold coins, but yeah.
Yeah. And then still swipe their card at their, you know, whatever.
Sure, sure, sure.
So it was somewhere around, 2012, I started following the Free State Project, because literally I was living in Phoenix. I wasn't really happy with where I was or what I was doing. And I thought, I want to move somewhere, go somewhere else, start a new life kind of thing. And I'm looking for any like pro-liberty think tanks around the world I could work at. And so I went to the Atlas Economic Research Foundation's compendium of global free market think tanks, and anywhere that was hiring, like I applied. I didn't care if it was in Lima or New Delhi or wherever else. I was just like, I want to do that. And then I came across one in New Hampshire, which, yeah, I always liked the East Coast better than, you know, the West Coast or whatever the vibe. And then, oh, there's this thing called the Free State Project. Are they hiring? No. And next.
Right.
But then I bookmarked, you know, I followed the Facebook page, followed what was going on. And over time that started to seep in. I'm like, wow, they're doing a bunch of cool stuff there. And it was, as ever, I'm sure this has been a catalyst for a lot of people's move, but when Keene State Rep Cynthia Chase said that Free Staters were the single biggest threat to the state in her eyes, and that she was going to seek limiting their freedoms as much as possible so they would just go away, I was like, this is incredible. Like, this level of pushback means there's some sort of a success thing. I have to get there now before there's no freedom left to like get. So within 9 months from that moment,
also seems like an odd strategy, right? We're gonna give them what they don't want. The problem is they're coming here because this is where you get more liberty. So what do you like? It's almost going against the grain.
Yeah. Well, that was it. Like, I just saw that something was happening here.
Right.
And anyone who's been in the old school political scene and has been trying to vote for more liberty has had a rough go of things the last generation or two. I mean,
yeah,
it's just not been going that well, especially on the macro level. And just to see anything resembling success just made my eyes light up. And
right.
So within 9 months, I was, you know, packed all my stuff and just moved out there out here, I should say.
Yeah.
And along the kind of time, I heard about Bitcoin and crypto, and I think in like the very beginning of 2013, there were some like articles I wrote that were about that. I kind of could have sworn I heard about it later, but apparently not. I was still trying to get like what Peter Schiff was offering, this like gold-backed debit card thing at the time.
Right.
And I was like, I want to get one of those. And it was like only US citizens. I was like, haha, good thing I'm a dual citizen. And I was like in the process of trying to do that when I came, you know, in face to face with crypto. And then I just kind of gave up on that.
Peter Schiff was so interesting in like sort of liberty circles in around 2012, because that was the year that he went to Occupy Wall Street and did that whole discussion with people down there. And now I just see him in crypto debates, which are, you know, it's a bit of a different flavor there. Mm-hmm. I don't know, we don't need to necessarily get into that, but so you moved here before you got into crypto, and I'm sure people did you get into it from people here
so I mean, I already knew about it and was a fan of it and all that kind of stuff. Apparently, my memory was a little bit hazy, but I just recently looked back and I was tweeting about it in like late 2012, early 2013.
Yeah.
But it was on the way through, on the drive from Phoenix to Manchester, that I stopped in Chicago and a friend was there and we had lunch and he paid for his part of the pizza in Bitcoin. He's like, why don't I send you some Bitcoin? I'm like, awesome.
So yeah,
that's where I got my first Bitcoin for pizza, you know, fittingly enough.
Yeah.
And then it was like $15 worth of Bitcoin at the time. And then by the end of 2013, that was worth like easily 150 as the big spike happened there.
Yeah, it was like that wasn't even like the run up from 100 to 1,000. You probably got it very early 2013. It would have been like tens of dollars.
Yeah, this was like September, so it was like 130 or something.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't quite that stratospheric, but it was still.
This is 10x.
And then it was all the way down. But since that moment, even though I was doing other things, I still was trying to use this as much as possible. Anytime we go out to eat with a bunch of friends, like, oh, I'll take the bill and everyone else pays in Bitcoin or whatever, and buying things with Bitcoin. It was like, you know, it was very much kind of a thing. And then in like the spring of 2014, like I was, you know, giving rides to people like gypsy cab style from Liberty Forum at the airport, this local, you know, event that takes place.
Right.
It was in Nashua at the time.
I was there this year.
Yeah. It was in Nashua in 2014 at the Radisson Hotel there, I believe. And so I was giving people rides to and from like the airport and stuff. And they're only taking Bitcoin. Although I believe Ian Freeman did pay me in $2 bills one time, but it's such an Ian Freeman thing.
Yes.
But so basically anything I could.
The other sound money.
Yeah. $2 bills.
Yeah.
But basically whatever I could to take, you know, to use what I could. And then the first Porcupine Freedom Festival or Pork Fest I attended was also in 2014. And that week I did not pack any dollars. I only had Bitcoin and I just spent it the entire week everywhere. This is 2014, right? Very long time ago.
Yeah.
Or 8 years ago, I guess.
I know, but it's crazy to think that was 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I could spend it everywhere there except for like one or two places. And there I just used it to buy some silver pieces that then I used to buy the thing I wanted. So
right.
it was still like a sound money experience. You
They're
know?
Very much. I remember listening to a report on Porkfest. I think it was from Planet Money, mm-hmm. like pre-crypto, maybe 2011, 2009, something like that, where it was people were just using silver and gold to buy things at that event. And I thought, whoa, that's really interesting.
Yeah. And then of course it turned into, you know, digital gold and
silver. Right.
And then that was 2014. I kind of did on and off stuff, but then it wasn't, you know, I worked part time for, you know, a political nonprofit in town and in the state, but it wasn't until like the end of 2015 where I started to feel like, you know what, like I'm starting to get a little like antsy, like I'm starting to get really into this crypto stuff.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm starting to get a little like, I've told a lot of people about it and I'm starting to feel like the burden of my recommendation is on my shoulders, you know?
Really? And also, so 2015, mm-hmm. I don't know if this affected you, but that was in the middle of like the biggest winter.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the biggest crypto winter, not actual winter. I think that actual winter was pretty bad too.
Yeah. But, the 2013-14 winter was bad, but
yeah,
it was like 2014-15 was around the bottom of the bear market.
Right. Right. So you're still in there and mm-hmm. you're kind of thinking, okay, what's going to happen now?
Yeah. I didn't really, it's funny because like future bear markets were always a little bit like tough, but that one wasn't because I didn't really have a lot of crypto at the time. And I just like, oh, wow, it went up. And then when it went, like, I remember like Bitcoin at like $100 basically or $130 and it never went anywhere close to quite that far down again. So I'm just
right.
like, I was never worried, but it was this whole right. like, well, I tell people be your own bank. That was a big thing that people were saying at the time. And I was like, can you be your own bank though? I think But I don't know. And so I decided, you know what? I'm going to just try it out. And so I just said, you know what? I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to only take work that pays me in Bitcoin and see what happens.
So obviously that would be very interesting for, let's say, a software engineer. Like, I don't know if, and you'd think that tech would be up on this, but like, there's no way they would make an exception and pay you in Bitcoin. Like, you have to have a bank account in order to work anywhere. Unless it's, you know,
yeah.
So that, did that really limit your options and where to work?
I mean, I guess the thing is like, it's one of those like the best stupid decisions of my life kind of thing where just like when I moved to New Hampshire, just because I thought cool stuff was happening here, didn't have any friends, didn't have any like jobs lined up. Like I just moved to like figure it out and it worked
right.
great.
Yeah.
It's another really stupid decision to just like quit everything and work for this like imaginary money nonsense. And like not, yeah. but it worked out great.
Stupid, but not at all stupid.
Yes. I started writing for Cointelegraph, which is a, you know, it's one of the major crypto news publications now and was then too, but you know, it's gotten quite big now. And so they would pay you in Bitcoin. And then I did some work for some other, I did some work in early 2016 for library, way back, and that was just very brief.
Yes.
And I,
actually, the other person who's been live in the studio is Jeremy Kaufman from library.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so back in the day, I did that, and then did some other random jobs and other things like that, and it was I still had a bank account though, and like I spent everything I could. Every time I needed to do anything with Bitcoin, I just do that. And when it came to rent, I was trying to sell my landlord at the time. I have paid rent in Bitcoin before, crypto before, but the one at the time where I was living, that he wasn't quite on it yet. He liked it, but he wasn't onto it yet. While I was convincing him,
It's good that it was like an individual. Not a company, like this building is a company, so that would probably be harder to convince.
Yeah. It was still possible. I could have probably gotten him to it if I had stayed there longer, but then I was still using my bank account to cash out whatever I need for rent and do that. But I'd still keep it all in Bitcoin and then do that.
So it sounds like you're moving into it step by step.
Yeah, well, that was the step my step was that's all I want to earn, right? I just want to earn and hold. That's my entire store of wealth and source of income. And I just figure out how to use it since after that. But it wasn't until it was like around May, I think, of 2016 that someone just fraudulently cleaned out my bank account right before I was going to pay rent. Like
this is what people are afraid of happening with Bitcoin, but this happened with your bank account.
Yeah. Just someone must have found some deposit slips somewhere we ended up getting it rectified. But the thing is, when you saw some random person scribbled something, not even remotely my name or my signature or anything. It's just like, how do you get someone who just like doodles on a piece of paper and then they just own all my money now?
I mean, it's
like,
happened. It hasn't happened to me, fortunately, but I mean, I definitely know people I've definitely had everyone's had the credit card taken and then all of a sudden there are these charges on it and you're like, well, what's this from? And
yeah.
So maybe similar to that, but that's scary that it's actually your account is being,
At least they get your number.
Yeah.
This is like someone just like scrawled on some piece of paper and just like, hey, and like they don't you have to have ID to like withdraw
stuff? That's nuts.
And it's just like, what the hell? And then, but anyway, they just said, oh, we're going to close your bank account and reopen you a new one. I'm like, okay, we'll just hold off on the reopen thing. And so I just like walked away with whatever cash I had left in there. And was like,
yeah. Well, did they eventually resolve it? Like, did they eventually get your money
back? Yeah, they did get it back.
Yeah.
They did get it back. And then they're like, well, for security reasons, we have to close it and start a new one. So I said, just hold off on starting the new one. And I just never went back. So that was, then I was like, oh, now I'm unbanked.
Yeah.
And that's a whole new world of like complexity.
How do you have your income in Bitcoin?
So back then it was, I would just post, I had a Bitcoin address in a spreadsheet that they use. I don't know what their accounting practices are like.
No, but like what job would pay?
So I was a crypto journalist. That's what I was. Like a journalist. Okay.
So like a Coin Telegraph or paying Bitcoin.
So that's I would do like copywriting and stuff for library. Yeah. Some of those early library blog posts that are Samuel Clemens or whatever name that they have in there was actually like mostly me and then someone else. Okay. There's a couple of those.
Gotcha.
And then I did for the old school people might remember the Bitcoin Bigfoot flyers. I wrote the copy for those. I just did a bunch of like random things. I even like helped fix up someone's barn, like did some manual labor for like Bitcoin back in the day too. Like I did a bunch of things.
Right. Okay. So you figured out a way to get your income in Bitcoin and then you figured out a way to pay your rent in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That sounds like that's most of the.
Yeah. And so it just all the in-betweens, it got really like, so obviously the big thing was he used this website called Purse, which still exists today, purse.io. Hit me up for a referral code. Just kidding. I don't have a referral code, but whatever. Basically lets you, people buy stuff on Amazon for you and ship it to your house and you pay them in Bitcoin for it. And that like you get a significant discount sometimes. Like 5%, I think, is the minimum, but some people have gotten as high as like 40%. So what can't you get off of Amazon? So that was like most things. And then there was a few little gift card apps where you could like keep like a tally, like, you know, of a gift card and then kind of do that to pay for things. And they're very advanced today, but they were very primitive back then. And then the last little thing was they had these like, part of my thing is like I don't know if everyone's familiar with the term KYC, but if you're a financial institution, you have to enforce AML KYC or anti-money laundering know your customer regulations, which basically means you need someone's ID and their
right
their actual their physical identity and their everything in order to transact.
That's why when you sign up for a lot of these crypto wallets, you have to take pictures of your driver's license.
Yeah. And so like I never did that with crypto because while I was living this, I wasn't doing a smart lifestyle. You know, this wasn't like I'm doing this because it seems like the smartest thing to do at this juncture in my life. I was living an experiment, right? And so I figured if I'm not going to have a bank, but I'm going to get a crypto bank, does that really count? So I was like, well, let's see what I can do without that. The whole be your own bank, permissionless money, all that kind of stuff. So there were a few of these like prepaid crypto debit cards that would ask for your ID once you hit like a $5,000 total spend limit. And then the regulations changed. It went down to like 2,500 and then went down to like 1,000 and then they got rid of them eventually. But while they were there, like I had like three of them that I was just like burning through.
So I was going to ask, like, what if I wanted to like, just go to the mall here and walk around and maybe buy a few things, you know, the bookstore, buy a book, like you would use one of those debit cards.
Yeah. For some things, because they were so limited, I would tend to, you know, use those for only the things I really needed to.
Yeah.
But, you could get gift cards. So I could like buy a gift card. Like say I'm going to go get some jeans at American Eagle. I could just buy a $25, $50 e-gift card with crypto. And then I'd walk all over there and here you go. And then do that and the rest in cash or whatever else I had. And
but what you if know. You needed to make like a spur of the moment purchase?
Yeah.
Or maybe it helped not do that.
Well, I mean, it became more complicated. Yeah. What really started to become more complicated was towards the end of 2016 for, people who haven't been using crypto this whole time won't maybe be fully familiar, but everyone remembers the late 2017 block size wars in Bitcoin, where it was like, oh, people are fighting over which is the real Bitcoin, all that kind of stuff. But that started affecting me in 2016. Like before I could go to some place, buy a gift card and I'd get it pretty much quick, like instantly or very much instantly. But then they started implementing like confirmation. When they kind of understood the tech more, they said, you need one blockchain confirmation, which is 10 minutes for Bitcoin.
Yeah. That doesn't sound so bad.
But then it wasn't 10 minutes. It was like 20, 30, 40 minutes. So like I have like scarring memories, like walking around the shopping mall for an hour waiting for a transaction to clear before I can like get the gift card and like walk back in.
Yeah.
And
some of those can take a while.
And so it started to become really difficult to continue to live on Bitcoin. And towards the end of the year, I was like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. And so, hey, do I stop what I'm doing? Do I just go back and get a bank account again and do all this stuff? Or do I find a different path? And so I thought I'm going to try to keep doing it, just switch cryptos. And at the time you got like, it was Bitcoin. And then after that was Ethereum, which is still very fast and cheap, which is a joke today.
Okay.
Considering that it was very fast and cheap at the time, but it wasn't used as money. So like I didn't care. And then, you know, Litecoin was nowhere near any kind of relevance, which I'd argue probably the same thing today, but like
it
was
that used to be the number two for a while.
It was at that point it was abandoned. Like
really?
It was completely abandoned in like late 2016. Like no one was using it at all.
Yeah.
And then Bitcoin Cash didn't exist for a year later. And so
and Litecoin is still like chugging along though. It's like
kind of
right.
I
mean, it's still on that like top. Maybe
top
it's not
20. It's in the top 20.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, it's funny because like next, if you release this like a week too late, it might be something completely different. You know the way crypto markets move.
No. I want to hear more about your story because you're narrowing down on coins too. But I also want to hear about like what's happening with all these coins on the market? Why did they stick around? Why do some die? Have some actually died? But yeah, why don't we keep going in terms of like what you were doing at the time in 2016, try to figure out what to use.
Yeah. So I just went down the list and the first one I stopped on that I could try to use was something called Dash, which used to be called Darkcoin back in like 2014 and then since rebranded to Dash. And so there was some bumps like in the transition because as a not super well adopted coin at the time, there was like half the things I could pay for with Bitcoin, I could pay directly to Dash. But the other half, there was this company called Shapeshift, which is still around in a very different form, but they had a little widget on a lot of these sites where you could enable pay with any coin you want and it would just auto shift into Bitcoin in the back end.
Mm.
And so I did like, so I basically got to resume my life the way I was, my like unbanked crypto life, except half of the time I'd have to go through this like shapeshift thing. And it, but then since then it got a lot easier. And then in the last, a couple years ago, it got, or a year or two ago, I guess, it got easier than living on Bitcoin, besides the whole like network issues and all like the actual thing. As far as like where I can spend it, I can spend it more places I can spend Bitcoin. And now it's kind of like more evening out, but, or it was until, you know, there's some, you know, recent advancements that's made it like super easy now. But,
to Dash.
Yeah.
So what would you say is like the main like technical differences between Dash and Bitcoin?
Yeah. So the main, I'll start with the main technical difference that made it more attractive at the moment at that time was purely a commitment to scale the blockchain on chain to make the blocks bigger. So the blocks are just the transaction capacity. And in Bitcoin, they're artificially restricted. They're not restricted at like, not like errors and problems happening. They're just limited to 1 megabyte worth of data.
Right.
And so the Dash blocks are, I believe, 2 megabytes right now, but come out at 4 times the rate. So it's like 8 times transaction capacity today.
Right.
And with a commitment to raise them as needed. Just there's not now, that much.
8 times the transaction capacity, but are less people using Dash today than Bitcoin?
I believe so, yeah.
So it's
and there was also even, that. Like there's also that, like I get to skip back a few years in terms of like, you know, congestion or whatever.
Gotcha.
That was the reason for changing. But the main technical differences, I mean, I guess I'm walking back from the exact decision, for my personal decision, right? Like the first thing, the obvious thing is less congestion. There still isn't congestion and there will probably never be congestion. Of course, you know, famous last words. The second thing is how would we get there? Bitcoin doesn't have a governance structure. There's no way of it making decisions. It's kind of a rudimentary governance structure. So it ended up being, that's where the block size war happened, where people just argued and fought and said, no, everyone wants this. No, everyone wants this. No, the miners signal for this. Ah, that's not it, but the user is this. And there was just, there's no neat way of solving which way are we going. And what happened at the end is it didn't get solved. It just, Bitcoin did its own thing. Then Bitcoin Cash split off and then split off and then split off. You know, that's a different story. But like, It just
remember that was very inconvenient for people holding it because now all of a sudden you have multiple coins.
Yeah,
I mean, on the other hand, you're like, hey, I just my coin just laid an egg.
Somebody laid a taxable egg. That's the problem. It just gets so annoying.
Yeah, but you can make money off of it.
It's so Dash has a governance structure, which basically means the holders get to have an actual vote on the protocol level.
Yeah,
and they did vote to pursue a big block scaling strategy, and then there you go. So now there's no argument, it's just going to go that way.
So is this sort of a similar scaling strategy to Bitcoin Cash, or would you say there's differences?
Yeah, basically. And I guess Bitcoin SV is kind of the, you know, again, I don't know how relevant it's going to be in the future, but it's kind of like the extreme end of that, of make the blocks as big as possible, push as much traffic through there as big as possible, and kind of like, you know, I wouldn't say recklessly is the word, but maybe like if it doesn't run smoothly, I don't care, but whatever. It's like, the thing is like, it's so funny how this became such a crypto political movement on either side, because it's just about like a different approach to making sure everyone can use it. And off-chain scaling or L2 scaling, like layer 2 scaling or whatever else, is just a different way of doing kind of the same thing with its own trade-offs.
And talk about the Lightning Network, because we did an episode about
it. We could go on that too. But
we
like,
can, yeah.
It's funny because it's been kind of like, it's just like when people say people of color or ethnic minorities or whatever, there's like very few that you're actually thinking of when you hear that term, even though the term actually encompasses lots of people. It's the same thing. It's like inner cities. Like you never think about like white people in inner cities, for example, like the automatic thought process. Same thing with scaling. Lightning is just what everyone thinks of, but that's not the only like off-chain or whatever other scaling thing.
Okay.
But so basically just the commitment.
Well, it's interesting because that's what I think of. So I'd like to know what else I should be thinking about that I'm not thinking about.
Yeah. Well, it's basically like everything kind of has its limits. The thing about second layers is if you push something onto a second layer, first off, you always have to contend with the first layer to get to the second layer. And so if you, you have to have a functional first layer for the second layer to function as well. And the second layer, depending on what kind of system it is, it has its own kind of, you know, drawbacks and whatever else. And so I like to think of, like, in my personal opinion, the smart move with first and second layers is segregate traffic types, like transaction types to them. Like, say if we're only talking financial transactions, not even data, I would say like layer one is like payments and your most payments and stuff. And layer two is like microtransactions, like little things back and forth, or like, you know, like let's say if I wanted to start a tab, I would open up a channel with someone, like a lightning channel with someone. It mean, and you don't really even need to do that unless, you know, I think there's plenty enough scaling capacity long-term that you wouldn't even need to do that. But just for argument's sake, and like every drink you buy, you push another little one on the other end of the lightning channel.
Sure.
And then we just settle up. But it's not like, okay, your money is all on this series of interconnected tabs and you're just trying to push it all over the place to make all your purchases, and only when you move it from your vault, it kind of becomes a little like which way do you scale? It's like, well, scale what? Which transaction types? And so, for example, Ethereum is another interesting example where all the money's on L1, or
right,
or all the money is on L1, but then all the data is on the first layer too, and it just becomes
right
really congested.
So we talked about how Lightning works on, mm-hmm. I actually don't think we got into the it's hard to do it on audio format to describe how Lightning works, but I can wrap my head around how Lightning works, sending, you know, cryptographic messages in order to get like, you know, something like a transaction between us. But to do the smart contract thing, mm-hmm. over those channels, has anyone tried to figure that out? Is that something that, like, have you ever, I've never heard of it.
So, well, and if we're just talking Lightning specifically,
right,
the thing is, like, the other thing is Bitcoin is constrained by the never hard fork again kind of ethos. And hard forks basically are breaking changes, a change where your software won't work unless you upgrade. And everything else hard forks, Bitcoin, BTC, Bitcoin doesn't. And there's good reasons for that. And there's, I think, a lot of bad reasons for it too. But the reality is then you're constrained by the innovation you can build on top of that because of that. And so, like, for example, if I were to design a second layer, right, you have like your first blockchain layer, which is, you know, the entire network sees it. It's, you know, highly secure, highly decentralized, all this kind of other stuff. What I would do is have like a, basically like, you know, a bridge over to a side chain that's much, basically like another blockchain that's like similar, but like very much more lightweight, not nearly as permanent. Like it gets pruned every once in a while.
Right.
And it's just like very fast confirmation times, all that kind of stuff. And then you just move your slow money into into the fast money pocket, transact, and that's fine. That's how I would have designed it, which as far as I know would be a little bit tricky to do natively on Bitcoin. The problem with the way the Lightning Network works is it's a interconnected web of two-way payment channels. So I can't just put my money onto Lightning. I have to put my money into a channel with you, and I can't send it to anyone else unless I send it over to you and you push it over to him,
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
I was going to say, can't you open a channel with yourself? And like, you can, but then you can only transact between these two.
And so if you want to receive money on Lightning, someone has to lock up money pointed only at you, or no one can send you money.
Right.
And it just, so as you can imagine in like a graph, if I want to send something to like someone who's like five hops away from you, I send to you to blah, 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 and then the end person is five hops away.
Yeah.
It obviously routes through that thing if it can find a route, but then the lowest amount of liquidity on that route is the weakest link. So if someone only has $20 in transaction capacity, I send $20 through, now I have to find a new route the next time I send through, or someone has to push money back through.
Right.
And you can just instantly imagine stuff starts breaking. Like routes start, it starts not routing payments. You have to rebalance your liquidity. You have to do this. It's just this endlessly complicated kind of system that's born out of this, that it doesn't need to be that way, except for, again, prioritizing for never hard fork. And all these payments have to be on the second chain, on the second layer, you know?
Yeah. So I want to come back to this. I want to talk about like scaling on layer one and what the trade-offs are on that. But before we get into that, like, what do you use today? Are you still on Dash mostly?
And yes.
Are you looking at anything else or is that
so
been working for you the best in terms of like, you know, living your day-to-day life on?
Yes. So from late 2016, maybe early 2017 to late 2019, I worked like full-time for Dash. Not for the main development group, but just myself and some other people started our own group that was funded under this decentralized autonomous organization. Basically, we just submitted a proposal to the network, the greater global network, and they approved it. And so we did that for a while.
And what was it?
So it was a group called Dash Force, which started as like a community energizer thing. Then we ended up doing like a news site and podcasts and all this kind of stuff, like media.
Oh, that's basically pretty cool. So you got paid to create content in Dash.
Yeah, and so paid, and it's kind of funny because like the entire time unbanked, but like my partner did have a bank account, and he when he tried to like cash out, sometimes he'd get asked weird questions like, hey, where'd the money come from? And they'd be like, because literally the money we got had no transaction history because it was created every month.
Right.
Like it was part of the coin getting created every month. It would just drop out of the sky. Yeah. And end up in our lab. No central. It's like, who paid you? Well, the sky did. It's like, it's kind of really cool, but like complicated to explain to people.
Well, the DAO that you talked about, the decentralized organization. I mean, wouldn't you say it came from that? I mean, I guess that you can, but you have to explain that.
And it gets a little like it's such a raw thing. Cause like every month there's a super block or like a big block with like 10% of all the coins that are created in that time period just come out all at once to whoever gets the most votes according to, you know, the governance system. And it just gets created, goes right there. And it's a very like raw and decentralized kind of a way. Now, for a contrast, you know, we're going to maybe get some hate for saying stuff like this, but it is what it is. Decred is a similar project to Dash. And I think they've had some interesting innovations in governance and things like that that Dash has not done, right? It's so I kind of view them as like a kind of like Florida and New Hampshire, both like pretty free states, but in like different ways in a lot of ways. So I kind of I view that the way their treasury worked for the longest time is every month some money would go into a pot and a group of people controlled the pot. And you had to trust an individual to honor that agreement and just say, whoever got the most votes, all right, we will manually pay them. And I believe they decentralized control over that, but it's still not as raw as like it came from the sky and no human being can stop it kind of thing, you know?
Right.
So to answer the kind of that long question, so during that time, all my income was in Dash. Since 2019, I've done some work here and there for Dash, but done a lot of work outside of it too. It's still the primary money I use because of the usefulness. So most places that accept crypto, especially here in New Hampshire, take, you know, Bitcoin Cash, and Dash. Sometimes like them, I mean, don't really use Litecoin. Now Dogecoin's pop back up here and there, but like,
do you ever use like Ethereum or Lightning?
No, no one uses. Well, there's a few people that use like actual establishments. Very few people use Lightning around here. It just, the technical overhead is so much more difficult. So almost all cryptocurrencies or almost all the cryptocurrencies that are used to pay for things are code forks of Bitcoin in some way, Dash included. So it's like a very same, it's kind of like a romance language where it's just like, all right, it's all basically the same, but these are the differences. And whereas like Lightning is a completely different, like Ethereum's is not a Bitcoin fork, but it's similar. It still uses enough of the same kind of architecture.
Right.
Lightning is just so radically different and has so many more like technical and setup costs that just tends to not be supported except by larger institutions and things. But so basically I could spend Dash anywhere. I could spend Bitcoin Cash or Bitcoin around here locally and for major services and things. But there's a couple of things that make Dash a lot easier to use and spend. And it's all, first off, there's this one app that I used for the longest time, I still use, called BitRefill. And BitRefill, you can use Lightning there, by the way, but you can't use Bitcoin Cash or some other things. And it's like the same old gift card service type thing as I've kind of used over the years, except you could buy it in precise amounts and it's a little bit faster. And also you can pay, that's why I pay my phone bill. You can top up your like prepaid phone bill or whatever. And there's this, over the last year, there's been this app called Dash Direct that does, it's US only, unlike Bit Refill, which is great internationally. It's Dash only and US only, but it significantly streamlines the user experience to where if you go anywhere over there to get like, you know, go to Old Navy, let's say you want to buy your shirt, whatever, it's like $25.69 is the total. You just type in $25.69, buy. Here you go. And they scan the gift card and then there you go.
Yeah.
It's cool. Smooth
enough. I'd like to try it.
Yeah. It's smooth enough to where you can use it in person.
Yeah.
But the coolest part that just is now coming out is there's this virtual MasterCard in there that basically what it lets you do, and I didn't believe this was possible when I saw it talked about, but then you know, I later became convinced that it's actually like a legal and legitimate thing, and I've used it a lot. Basically, you can get a prepaid MasterCard, a virtual card in the app that then you can load up to $1,000 worth or a total of $1,000 a day, and you know, whichever one is lesser, I guess, and then just spend it anywhere that MasterCard is accepted in the US. And you don't have, and so literally what you can do, and the online functionality has been there, or the key in the card manually stuff has been there. What's just coming out like right about around like now, like / when we're talking / when this thing is released.
Yeah.
Like, that's where it gets dicey.
It'll be this week. So,
dicey about next week. That's where it gets dicey about the exact dates and stuff. But I've seen people like load it onto their Apple Watch through like Apple Pay. And you can do NFC, but basically you can go up to Whole Foods. I'm not actually going to use Whole Foods because you can't get gift cards for Whole Foods. Let's just say like an independent coffee shop, like, you know, whatever. Name one. It doesn't matter.
So those crypto meetups in Portsmouth, do you run those or is that? Yeah. Okay. So I've gone to one or two of them. Those coffee shops down there. Do they accept?
The one that I did the crypto meetup was does accept crypto, including Dash directly, and the owner holds it.
What's that one in Portsmouth called?
That's a Maison Navarre.
Okay.
There's also
Maison Navarre.
There's also Fresh Press and Fresh House. They all take crypto directly. Okay. But let's talk about one that doesn't.
Oh, not this Pressed. The Fresh. You got to get the Pressed around here. Use it.
But let's say Pressed. I could pay at Pressed.
Okay.
By all you have to do, you go up. Like, what's your total? $25.89 or whatever. And you quickly load $25.89 onto your card. You spend the Dash and it turns into $25.89 on your balance. NFC, beep, you pay.
Yeah.
And so it's basically a one app mass adoption solution that, you know, even some, I've talked to some like
Bitcoin. And the app is Bit Refill?
No, this one's Dash Direct.
Dash Direct, sorry.
Yes. You're
getting those confused.
It's like one app that lets you literally, and the part that isn't kind of replicated elsewhere is you don't have to give up custody of your money, as in you can literally have your Dash in private keys that no one can touch, right? The equivalent of cash in your pocket
up until the
last 5 seconds, literally five, and only in the exact amount that you need for the purchase. And you don't have to, it can be attached to a fictional name. It's not attached to your actual identity.
So literally sucks it in
Yes. That's so it's literally like the unbanked, living on crypto unbanked tool in one app, which did not exist until like the last few months, and it's pretty cool. And there's a few other services. I'll have to I think Pay with Moon might be, I can't remember if Moon Pay or Pay with Moon is one of those things. And there's some other one that are starting to do similar things with other cryptos but aren't nearly as advanced yet. But so the good thing gives me like hope. I mean, right now we're using one app to just live on crypto, but in like 6 months, a year, there might be many that you can do the same thing. And it's to the point where I don't have to you don't have to train people like, oh no, you got to use this service. You got to use this. You got to use this one service and you can live off crypto pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question I want to follow back up on, which I'm afraid, I'm afraid there's going to be a half hour answer and I don't think we have the time to do it.
Yeah.
We'll
shorten it if you
want. Yeah. Well, okay. You know, so we talk about layer one scaling versus layer two scaling. Mm-hmm. So obviously there are a lot of criticisms of layer one scaling as well. Like if every transaction has to be owned by every node, and at some point that's, that's N squared. You know, if you, it's the number of nodes times the number of transactions is the number of data, is the amount of data. And so, do you think that's going to be a problem at some point? And how do you, how do you see that, like, you know, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, does a layer two still come in at some point, or is it more about the trade-offs between layer one and layer two? How do you look at this whole issue?
I mean, depending on what you want to do, if you want to have a limited blockchain, I don't think you necessarily need a layer two. I do think a second layer, or at least the possibility for one, is always a good idea. So there's a lot of, you're starting to find this happening. So Dash is released, just for the Dash example, is releasing like a decentralized application layer, and it's having a side chain, at least a separate chain attached to it, that's much more lightweight, much more pruned, not nearly as final and strong and whatever, because it's all state transitions or data transactions. Like every time you update your Twitter bio, that's a little whatever.
It's in someone's database.
Yeah, but so that can be pruned, for example. You can just cut that off and stuff. And for example, Bitcoin Cash has a sidechain called Smart BCH, which is kind of like a, Ethereum clone type deal, but it's like a data layer that bridges back to, and that also very much, very fast, very lightweight, whatever, prune transactions, not nearly, you don't care about decentralization as much. You don't care about permanence of each transaction as much as like the main chain. And, obviously Bitcoin has like financial transactions on layer one, but like usually big ones. And then Lightning is like layer two, which is all the small payments and starting to do data things. Like Sphinx Chat is like a messenger that uses Lightning transactions to do stuff. So just about every single major system is starting to segregate into these two layers. It's just that like the choices of what you put on a layer is kind of different. And that's the thing, is like the thing with layer one, the big trade-off that people like to say with like infinite scaling is it makes nodes expensive to run. And right. So basically it means there's going to be fewer people running a node, and therefore it's probably going to be big companies, therefore probably going to be easier to censor, kind of thing. That's sort of the argument. And on the other side, there's the argument of, well, maybe tech, I forget which law, someone's law for everything these days, but whoever's law it is, it says that like the technology is going to, like the technology, the like hardware and bandwidth and stuff grows at a certain rate. And basically the gamble is...
So whatever corollary to Moore's law.
Yeah, would be, pretty much like that. Yeah, so like the whole Moore's law thing of like it's going to keep on growing fast enough to where financial transactions don't like outpace it.
Yeah.
And so, but the thing is, so if you have everyone run their node at home with Bitcoin, which, I've done before, I've ran a Lightning node until it became unprofitable to do so. And then when you have that, okay, but then if you can't, if everyone kind of can run their own node, but sort of doesn't, but then you need to use a large, well-funded hub, like a Lightning hub, like say Async is like the largest node on the network last I saw, or like all the exchanges run these big liquidity hubs because you kind of need it to be smooth, then you have that centralization vector there, obviously I'm a little bit biased on this stuff, but like I like the idea of incentivized infrastructure, and like the Dash system pays people to run nodes, so therefore you can afford a larger setup. It's not like you're a hobbyist losing money running your own node.
So how does it pay people to run nodes? Because they're not mining. They're not actually getting block rewards. So what's the incentive?
So the masternode system, and that's a term you hear a lot of times in crypto now, but like Dash was the first one to come up with it, is basically like you run a high powered node that does a bunch of this cool stuff. You're paid to run. You basically don't get paid if you don't have certain specifications for performance. And in order to have the privilege of doing this, you have to post bond or like prove ownership of, in Dash's case, like 1,000 units of Dash to show you have skin in the game. You can't Sybil attack the network. And it's kind of like, it's sort of like a proof of, like similar to proof of stake, except it's not the consensus layer. This is just to run nodes and not to actually mine the blocks. So Dash has miners too.
Right.
And Decred has a hybrid system too of staking and mining, and there's a few other things that have a few other, like Horizon, or used to be called Zencash, also has, I believe it has mining, but also has secure nodes and master nodes, two different incentivized node types. But basically the outside capture concern is kind of done away with if the network pays for its own internal thing. It's like,
right,
if you're paying for your own security and infrastructure as a network, you don't have to worry that a company comes in from outside and kind of does that.
Yeah. And I'm also wondering about what you said about like the censorship if there are a few nodes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the same thing as like social media censorship where you could mm-hmm. have no, you know, where, you know, maybe you want to say something, but anyone who's going to broadcast it, all you have to have is one person broadcast your transaction and mm-hmm. then you're fine. So it's more like,
yeah,
it's a little bit, I feel like people have the social media censorship model, and I'm thinking off the top of my head here, and I'm thinking a little differently. It might be harder to censor when all of these transactions, a lot of these, you're not really going to be sure what they are. Mm-hmm. So it would be expensive to do so. And even so, like, even if all the major miners mm-hmm. are trying to censor you, you only need to get through one,
yeah.
you know.
And that's one reason why privacy is very important, too,
yeah.
because then
the
information of who you're going to censor, it's already pseudonymous, but if you can start making those connections. Yeah, I agree. The thing is, that's one other reason I became a little bit more skeptical of, like, again, I think that having the Lightning Network is better than not having Lightning or Bitcoin. I don't want to get that twisted, but
yeah,
I've
used Lightning Network. It's actually a lot of fun.
The liquidity model where you need liquidity to, you don't just need the money to send, you need liquidity to receive money. Like that whole thing makes it much easier to censor in my view, because like I've run dozens of different kinds of cryptocurrency nodes, like a library node. I've run a Dash node, obviously Bitcoin Cash. I've run Gulden, which is some weird, like, you know, Dutch cryptocurrency. I don't know if it's going anywhere right now, but I've run so many different nodes. It's easy enough on like a laptop for a lot of these, obviously not in the future necessarily, but like, or get yourself a Raspberry Pi. And so if someone's trying to censor you, let me just run to Best Buy, get some parts. Here we go. Boom. I got my node up. The problem is if someone's trying to censor you with the big liquidity network on the Lightning Network, like the difficulty, first off, you have to close all your channels, which takes a lot of time, a lot of money and all that kind of stuff. And then you got to find a way to bootstrap yourself back into a different system through a different node. And it's easier to find individual nodes and censor them. And how do you get the liquidity? It just becomes a lot harder to just switch nodes.
Gotcha.
Whereas, you know, it's an easier censorship vector. And of course the argument is, well, then you just pay a higher Bitcoin transaction fee and do it on chain. Like, yeah, it's true too, I guess, but
yeah,
you know,
it's a different way of doing it. It reminds me, and I don't know what to make of this. I'm just off the top of my mm-hmm. head now. It kind of reminds me of like 10 years ago, how you would hear from companies like Google, like this whole, Google was very strongly supporting net neutrality. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time, one of their main arguments was, if we lose net neutrality, mm-hmm. then these carrier companies, you know, mm-hmm. are going to start censoring your political speech. That was like one of their main arguments.
Yeah.
And that never happened on that layer, only on the Google layer itself. Yeah, it's so interesting how that is funny, but it's also interesting how, well, there's an important question here, and I'm not expecting you to answer it. I'm just like, okay, now I'm thinking like, why does censorship occur at one layer versus another? And
because it's easier.
Right, because it's easier. Right, exactly. And so you'd have to look at the, how could you have predicted that at the time? Mm-hmm. You have to look, well, how does Google work? How does, I don't know, what are these companies that do like Verizon, AT&T, that control?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, how do they work? And would there have been able to work forward and figure out what's going to happen? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I certainly couldn't have done it. But I'm just starting to think along those terms.
Yeah. So the censorship question is always very interesting, because obviously you have to think about first who has incentive to censor, but then also you got to think about like the ease of doing so. And so for like censoring nodes and stuff, I think if it's easy enough, people go for that, right? If it's like you have 10 nodes and they're all like six are located in the US and three are in Western Europe and like one is like in Japan or something, let's just say.
Right.
If it would be pretty easy to say this person's a terrorist, 10 nodes that we know, you may not broadcast transactions from this address.
Right.
That should be pretty easy to do, right? Now, if you have something like Bitcoin has like 10,000, 20,000 nodes somewhere. It is a lot of nodes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's big mining farms.
In just about every country.
Yeah, but there's mining, there's kind of miners everywhere a little bit. Or, you know, even like what Dash has, like 4,200 master nodes and, you know, a bunch of other stuff. Like when you start to have that kind of scale, that doesn't become a problem. Then it becomes like, okay, well, if you have money from this address, because then it becomes the privacy angle, right? Where it's like, okay, this is who this person is, persona non grata. We're going to make it a crime to transact with this person. So even though that person can move, it's just like, if you can find out that you've interacted with that, there could be legal repercussions, and people in most of these countries wouldn't want to do it. And then, so the way you solve that then is having actual like privacy, so you can kind of hide who they're from, or like, you know, blind to that. Then the next level though is, so you have, there's a bunch of coins that have some sort of advanced privacy mechanisms, including on the Bitcoin layer itself, including Bitcoin Cash. Fun fact, I'm probably going to release it tonight, but I did a podcast with the Ronin Dojo people who have like their like full node Bitcoin like software and hardware. And there's this thing called like Whirlpool, which is a big coin join, like a big privacy pool in Bitcoin. And supposedly there's more Bitcoin in Whirlpool than the Lightning Network right now. So more people have it in the mixing service than in Lightning, because they're still using a lot of privacy on there. So that can help. The thing is, then the problem becomes regulatory in terms of exchanges, because Monero is, I think, probably unique in all the cryptocurrencies in that it is hardwired to never kind of be compliant, really. Like, as in, it is almost like you can't use it transparently, really.
And that's so interesting.
It makes it difficult to integrate into a lot of services, because in order to communicate with the node has to know certain information and stuff. It's been historically difficult, but more importantly, like Zcash, I would think, again, I'm not an expert in the matter, but I think the Zcash probably has significantly more robust privacy techniques than Monero. However, Zcash is also able to be used completely transparently. Therefore, highly regulated New York exchanges like Gemini will support Zcash, but Monero is kind of probably the most panned major cryptocurrency from that layer. So then it's like, well, if we can block you from buying it, then it's like, then we can kind of censor that. And the answer to that is DeFi and decentralized exchanges, because then you can't really block that level.
Yeah.
And then what's the answer? And then again, it's a constant snowball of anti-censorship.
Yeah, we're getting pretty far, and there's already there's a lot of things for people to look up.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
From this show, and you're giving me a lot of work to do on this show notes page. I'm worried that's going to take me a lot of time. Let's maybe finish off with something like kind of forward-looking. Maybe you can give me something optimistic here, although if you want to go the pessimistic route, that's okay too. But where do you see our crypto future lying? I mean, I still think that this stuff is going to have, you know, you talked about stuff we can do to get on it today. You're on a crypto standard today, but what happens when this is broadly used? Are we on the precipice of this at some point in the next decade? And what does that look like? What changes are we going to see?
Yeah. So
it could be a 2-hour podcast just on this.
Well, but I can condense it in probably 10 minutes or less. Let's see.
Okay.
So I think that within the next 5, because, you know, crypto goes into cycles and stuff.
Yeah.
And this cycle, we got so close to wide adoption. I mean, there's like a widely available app that lets anyone live on crypto already, as I just mentioned before with Dash Direct. But as far as AMC Theaters was taking it, as far as like a bunch of cities, including the city of Portsmouth, who were taking it for taxes and stuff, like there's a bunch of we're so close to mass adoption, right? And I think that this operates, I don't know, sure, it's 4-year cycles, but market cycles were kind of on the down at the time of this podcast. I think in the next 4 or 5 years, when we're back up, is going to be like, maybe not everyone's using crypto, but like a good chunk is, like a good 20% might be used. Like I would call like the mass adoption phase, where it starts to become widely adopted at that point.
Because they usually call that like the early majority.
Yes, early majority, to where it's like, it's kind of like where, do you remember when like Apple Pay came out and then like some people would be paying with Apple Pay places? It's like the same thing where like most places you can probably pay with this. Not everywhere, and few people are using it, but you can probably do that.
Yeah, I had the other day I had to do something at the at the post office, and I wasn't even thinking about it. I was like trying to pay. I was like, boop. And they were like, looked at me like, sir, this is the post office.
We don't do anything.
I was sorry. I'm just okay. I'll give you my credit card. Like, I don't, like, yeah. have to be so.
You know, it's funny. Multiple times.
I just wasn't even thinking.
Multiple times, a mutual friend of ours has had me pay the bill because he forgot his wallet, and he asked them if they take Apple Pay, and they don't.
Yeah.
Because New Hampshire is a little, I wouldn't say technologically backward, but it's not like downtown Manhattan, you know, it's much more rustic. It's much more.
I've been able to use Apple Pay pretty much
most places.
Well, of course, this is Salem, and we're in the southern New Hampshire.
Like, we're not like a local, like old school business won't
right.
So that if Apple Pay is there, you know, crypto's going to get to Apple Pay in like the next 5 years or maybe 10 years. That's what.
That'll be interesting.
That's number one prediction, is you're going to be able to spend like all your payment apps, like your PayPal's and your Cash App and all that kind of stuff, are going to have crypto in there, and you'll be able to spend it. And you'll probably be able to spend raw crypto as well, like cash crypto, right? Digital cash, in the next 5 or so years. That's one prediction. Second prediction is just about everything we rely on. Like, if you think about not having a internet presence, I think that in the next 20 years, not having a decentralized presence is going to be the same thing in a certain way. And what I mean by that is, like, I think most major cryptocurrency exchanges are just going to become fiat front ends, as in they like to liaison to your bank account to get crypto, but all the crypto trading stuff is all going to be plug and play decentralized exchanges like, say, Thorchain. And it's already starting to happen a little bit in a few early adopters, but I think that or an exchange has tons of crypto like on hand that they're using for this stuff, is just going to go away. And you'll be able to just access everything on DeFi and DEXs and stuff like that in the future. It's just in the very near future, like in the next few years, it's going to be pretty big on that. We're also going to see this might be closer to 10 years, I guess, but I'm guessing we'll see major things migrate to, like, maybe major records keeping type things migrate to digital things, more specifically NFTs. So, like, for example, the last Super Bowl, they gave every person a commemorative NFT of their ticket. I mean, the Super Bowl is as big as you get. But like the next Super Bowl, but in 5 years, you're going to get your NFT ticket, and that's what you're going to use to actually get into the Super Bowl and then keep it on the way out. You know, and then people are going to, like, they already sold a house as an NFT in Florida using that as like a digital record. We're going to have like decentralized digital records for a lot of things. Of course, still the old school nonsense too, but like in the next 5 to 10 years. And the thing that most people aren't really predicting, I think there's going to be some kind of a regulatory truce with crypto. Like, I don't take the view that, oh, they're just going to ban it. It's like, no way.
There's two opposite views. There's one that's going to ban it, and the other one, I think, on the other side is
it's going to go away.
So you think that there's some equilibrium point that we can.
Yeah, it's kind of like Uber. Remember when Uber was just crashing in and just all the regulators were banning it, and finally they're just like, "Come on, can we just?" They kind of worked it out.
Yeah,
it's the same.
In some cases, not as bad. Like in New York, they kind of took it away from us. There's Uber in New York. You use Uber, but they kind of took away the benefits of it.
Yeah.
Like you still use it, but it's like, okay, it used to be a lot cheaper. It used to be a lot nicer. And now it's like not as good as it once was.
It's like a taxi now.
Yeah.
And so I think that we're going to have that with crypto, where I don't think this whole, like, you got to track every single transaction for capital gains nonsense is going to stay. I think we're going to have like a de minimis exemption probably. And I also think that like this whole, you can't use crypto without KYC, like the way they're starting to try to do now, I don't think that's going to work either. They're just going to find a way to just be like, look, pay your damn taxes on this stuff and we'll make it easy for you. We're not going to be as annoying as we are now. And then they'll be like, well, I'd rather do that than live in fear. So, okay.
Yeah.
Even though I could. And I think there's going to be like a streamlining of things and like all these weird financial regulations of like, oh, you have to be, this has to be registered as a security if this, because like with DAOs and stuff, and it just, they're going to have to be some kind of, like, the government's gonna have to like kind of like take what they can get, because they want money. They don't want no money. we're seeing that with like weed and stuff, right? Where
right.
they want a piece of that weed money finally. And it's the same with crypto.
It kind of reminds me of like the music industry. Like people are like, okay, we're never going to pay for songs again because it's all digital. Well, no, like, you know, they came up with some synthesis. I don't know if you want to say truth. There was a lot of pain along the way.
Yeah, but that's exactly it. It came to the synthesis of before you have to play by the rules, and then it just became so easy to not play by the rules, like LimeWire and all the other stuff, like, you know, torrenting. And now it's just like, they're just like, come on, dude, like, just look, $5 a month, Netflix or whatever, just, you can watch whatever, just pay with something, or Spotify, just listen to some ads, you can do it. Like, there's going to be this coming together of everything.
Yeah.
That's going to be fun.
That's going to be fun. But I think what's going to be even more fun, and we talked about this a little bit before the show, is like, if people are on a hard money standard, how are attitudes and behaviors going to change in terms of like consumer behavior? And I think that will be really interesting to observe.
Yeah. The consumer behavior thing, like obviously, you know, the super quick rundown of that is just if you have a short time preference because your money goes down in value or doesn't go up in value, you're going to spend a lot more crap. Whereas if you can save and if holding onto your money long-term builds your wealth, it's easier for the average person to do that, then when you do spend it, because saving is not spending it. Saving is spending it later.
Right.
And so
eventually you get to later.
Yeah. Eventually you get to later. Eventually you spend it. You're going to get higher quality goods and services that people really want, which will cause some sectors of the economy to go away, but it'll be replaced by other ones. But I just think that the big revolution when anyone can be paid from anywhere in the world, I just think that it's going to have a great equalizing factor, not only globally, like poor and rich countries won't be as separated as they are today. Like you'll be able to hire, like, for example, probably one of the very best Dash developers today is this guy called Wisdom from Nigeria. He's this young Nigerian kid and he's like making, I don't know what he's making, but I'm sure he's making the same as like the American developers and stuff. And like, isn't that great? And so, but also the equalizing of this employer-employee relationship thing, where it's like, everyone's going to be kind of like the good version of what an Uber driver was, is in, you know, independent contractor, pick your own hours, but not in this way where it's semi-exploitative, like with Uber,
right.
But like everyone's their own like entrepreneur sort of thing. I think it's going to move more in that direction where your boss telling you where you got to show up to work, except for certain meetings, like maybe once a month or something,
right.
What your hours are, what you like, all this kind of like this hierarchy of things, I think is going to decentralize as well. And I think it's going to give a lot more people a lot more happiness.
Yeah. Well, that would be great. I really hope we live in the world where like they don't make them like they used to, which has been a phrase probably for 100 years. It's all of a sudden becomes a good thing. Like now they used to make crap and now they start making good quality things that last.
I mean, have you seen food? Like, did you see what people ate in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s?
No.
Who's well, like, weird, like,
I guess
Jell-O ham dessert thing growth. But, like, also think about the fast food boom and how now we're, like, we're getting past, like, where everyone's eating McDonald's and stuff. It's, like, only some people are doing that. And, you know, there's higher quality. Like, there's the chains are higher quality and stuff. And it's just, like, I think that we're seeing quality kind of come back in a lot of ways where everything else, you know, disposable, crappy, whatever else. It's kind of coming full circle a little bit.
All right. Well, I hope so. That's a really interesting idea. And if that starts to happen and this show is still around, maybe I'll refer back to it.
Absolutely.
So Joel, thank you so much for coming on. We took a lot of time. We had a lot of stuff to discuss. I feel like we could probably get more shows out of this, and maybe we will in the future. But thank you so much for coming on. Any last takeaways before we head out? And where can people find you online?
Yeah. Well, last takeaway is you can basically live, not only can you live on crypto today, but you can start your own business today. You can run on decentralized infrastructure. You can kind of do everything yourself today. Like, this is a time with the opportunity for unprecedented freedom, and you better start taking advantage of it, or you should earlier the better, because, you know, the old world as it's dying off might take some victims with it. Just don't be one of those. That's kind of my general thought. I'm on Twitter at the Desert Links. Isn't desert is in hot place, you know, Links is in kitty cat, right? Not the Desert Linux. right? So
okay,
the Desert Links on
because
Twitter.
You're from the or because you lived in the Southwest.
That's kind of the you know, I was looking for a blog name back in 2011, and that's just what it ended up being. I'm like, all right, I'll keep that. It's a fun moniker.
From the desert.
It's like the Desert Fox or
not
whatever.
Not the desert anymore.
Yes, which makes it funny. And then I have a show called the Digital Cash Network, which is on YouTube, on Odyssey, which is the library-based thing. It's on Anchor, you know, Spotify, iTunes, all the other stuff. So those are the two words. And there you go. You can just find anything. Feel free to reach out to me at any time.
And all of it will be on the show notes page. I'm trying to think of what the I will announce the show notes page in about 30 seconds once the show ends, and then I'll come back on. But look at all this. Look at all these notes I have that I'm going to have
to.
You're going to have to pin it on
the wall there. Look at this one.
Maybe I'll just take a snapshot of this and put the image on the show notes page. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, this is episode 224, so you can get all this information at localmaxradio.com/224, along with Joel's YouTube and Odyssey pages, which I believe is called the Digital Cash Network. And yes, I still have a lot of these links I have to put up on the show. So show notes page once again, episode 224 on localmaxradio.com. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.